This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we'll talk about rainforest conservation. But first, if you're a Wall Street analyst or a broker and you go on TV to talk about a stock, you have to disclose whether you own or control any of the shares of the stock you're talking about so we can judge if you have a conflict of interest in your recommendations. Now, many pharmaceutical companies listed on the stock exchange provide funding for basic and clinical research that's done at universities. And in many cases, the scientists doing the research publish their results in reputable journals. Yet the researchers may not mention in their papers that they have a vested interest in the outcome of that research. In other words, it's not clear to readers that the scientists stand to make money if their research leads to, say, a blockbuster new drug. For example, the scientific journal Nature Neuroscience has come under fire in recent months for an article it published last year on three treatments for depression. The author wrote favorably about these three different products, but failed to mention that he had financial interests in all three of them. Here's the rub. He was not violating the journal's disclosure policies. Now, some scientists did not take kindly to this perceived conflict of interest, and they signed a letter to Nature, the Nature Research Journals, and the journal Science, demanding stricter policies. And this week, the editors of Nature announced their new financial disclosure policy in the October issue of Nature Neuroscience. This hour, we'll talk with an editor at Nature and one of the scientists who signed the letter asking for stronger disclosure policies. Why this sudden interest in a conflict of interest if research like this has been going on for years? And what do you think? Should scientists be allowed to publish their work knowing that they have a financial interest in the stake of the outcome of that research? What do you say? Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Charles Jennings is the executive editor for the Nature Research Journals in New York. He joins us in our New York studios. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Ira.
You're welcome. Mildred Cho is a senior research scholar and associate director of the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ira.
Charles Jennings, let's talk about these journals I mentioned. They came under fire for publishing a scientist in there, for publishing a review paper in which the researcher wrote favorably about these three products, but didn't reveal the relationship, correct?
That's correct.
And it was not against the policy.
No. Our policy at that time did not require authors of review journals to disclose their financial interests in the work that they're writing about. We should distinguish between review articles and primary research articles, and all of the Nature journals adopted a policy about 2 years ago of requiring all authors of primary research papers to make a statement that will be published along with the article stating whether or not they have a financial interest in that research.
And the difference, what's a review article versus a...
Yeah, so a research article is a paper that describes the results of an experiment that the authors performed. A review paper is a paper in which the authors discuss other authors' findings. What's the state of the field?
Right.
What's happening? What's interesting? What's important? There's some critical evaluation of the primary research literature. So there is obviously, in principle, scope for bias and interpretation in those kinds of articles.
So then when they reviewed the state of the field at that point, they did not mention, oh, we have a stake, we have an interest in this field.
That's right. They didn't, and nor did we ask them to. Our policy didn't require it.
And that's changed now.
That has changed, and we've just made the decision that from now on we will apply to review articles exactly the same requirements as we've, for the last 2 years, been applying to research articles. In other words, every author, at the time that their paper is accepted, will be asked to provide a statement as to whether or not they have a financial interest in the work.
Dr. Cho, you were one of the several scientists who signed a letter to Nature criticizing that policy. What were your recommendations?
Well, I think one of the things that the group felt was important was to have readers be able to get information about the financial interests of the authors, as you mentioned, and that those standards should apply to all of the different kinds of articles that are published. And in fact, that review articles might actually be considered to have a higher standard of disclosure than research articles because unlike research articles, which describe work that could be, in theory, repeated or replicated by other scientists who might not have the same financial interests. Review articles don't necessarily have you don't necessarily have that possibility, and there's more of a potential for bias to creep in.
Mm-hmm. And you'd say that all, not just those review articles, but all authors and editors and people associated with any kind of review of articles should also disclose what their financial interests are.
Yes, that was our recommendation in the letter, that all the people that are involved in the review process should disclose their potential for bias.
Mm-hmm. Including referees who might be judging an article.
That's right.
Charles, any comment on that?
Well, that's quite challenging for scientific journals, of course, because we allow our referees to remain anonymous, and we do that for a number of reasons, but the fundamental one is that a referee has to be free to tell the editor what they really think of the paper, and of course what they will say to the author's face may be very different from what they will actually say to the editors and what they think in private. And many of our referees are relatively young people, you know, they may be postdocs or junior professors at the start of their careers, and they may be reviewing the papers of much more senior scientists who may one day be reviewing these people's promotion applications, you know, tenure grant applications. There is a potential power imbalance, and the only way we think that we can control that is to allow the referees to be anonymous. And many reviewers have told us that they would not agree to review for us unless we allowed them that protection. So the idea that one can make public disclosure of the reviewers' conflicts of interest or potential conflicts of interest, I think is worthy but unworkable in practice, in our view.
Dr. Cho, what do you say to that?
Well, one option that might be somewhat of a compromise or a way of kind of trying to tread the line between two different conflicts of interest that Charles Jennings points out is for the editors or the publishers to ask the referees to disclose conflicts of interest confidentially to the publishers or the editors, and for the journals to make some statement about whether the referees had a conflict of interest or not without disclosing the identity of the reviewers.
Charles is shaking his head here.
My head was probably wobbling diagonally, so I half agree and half disagree. Yes, in fact, we already do a lot of that. We do ask referees to tell us, the editors, if they have some conflict. We ask them to exclude themselves if they perceive that they have a strong enough conflict that they can't be objective about the paper. We as editors try very hard not to send it to people that we think will have a conflict. And we also, I'm sorry. Yep, so we try to avoid sending it to anyone who we think has a conflict. And we also allow the authors the option of excluding anybody who they think has a conflict. So if they tell us, please do not send it to Dr. X, we will honor that request. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of safeguards in place to ensure that the authors get a fair hearing.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Cho, your letter also recommends that the journal, quote, reject submissions where authors' conflicts are incompatible with the integrity of science. What does that mean? What did you mean by that?
Well, I hope that there are not many situations in which that occurs, but I think that statement was in the letter to leave room for situations that might be on the sort of egregious end of financial conflicts of interest. And I think most scientists don't have those kinds of very extreme financial conflicts of interest. But I think that statement was in there to leave room for journals to do more than just disclosure, and to go beyond disclosure and actually draw their own lines in terms of determining whether there are some financial conflicts that are just so extreme, maybe because the amount of the financial conflict is so large that the integrity of the science or the interpretation might be called into question.
Mm-hmm. Charles Jennings, you write in your editorial that there is good reason to believe that when you have industry funding, there is a pro-industry result, right, of research.
Yeah, there have been several studies that have looked at this, so these are meta-analyses of large numbers of papers, mainly in the clinical rather than the basic science literature. And what these papers have found is that that industry funding is associated with pro-industry outcomes. So in other words, if you're funded by a drug company and you're testing a particular drug, on average, you're more likely to get a positive result than if you weren't so funded. Now, the problem there is that there hasn't been very much. In fact, I'm not aware of any comparable studies in the basic science literature. And of course, the Nature journals mainly publish basic science. We certainly move into clinical terrain sometimes, but we mainly focus on basic science. And there is much less information about the effect, or potential effect, of these financial interests in the case of basic research than for clinical trials.
And Mildred Cho, you have followed the money in some of these studies.
Yes, with a colleague of mine, Lisa Barrow, at the University of California in San Francisco, we did do a study of clinical drug studies that were published in the literature and did find the same kinds of results that that Charles mentioned. That is, that studies that were industry-sponsored tended to favor the product that was manufactured by the sponsoring company. But others have also done some related studies on faculty in the life sciences. So, for example, David Blumenthal has done some research surveying biologists and researchers in the life sciences who have reported themselves that, or you could infer from their own reports, that they are more likely to withhold data if they have been involved in and have commercial ties with companies. So it's a different kind of effect than the publication, but it is an effect that would have impacts on publication of data if they're withholding it or are less likely to publish.
Charles, what happened to the old idea? Maybe it's now central casting figure in Hollywood of the poor scientist who studied and did research for the better good of mankind, and maybe someday he'd pick up a Nobel Prize, but certainly not worry about the pot of gold at the end of any rainbow.
I actually don't think that stereotype is quite as dead as some people would like to believe. I think that most scientists are motivated by something like that. And obviously, it's great if you make millions of dollars through some patent, you know, royalties on some patent. This is wonderful, and it will change your life. But most scientists, I don't think, get into science with that as their primary goal. I mean, they would be stupid if they did, because most of them won't succeed. There are much better ways for smart people to make money. So I think that the motivation of most of these people who do have financial interests is not primarily self-enrichment. The financial interests and the money that they will make is a consequence of commercial success, which is, of course, a consequence of practical impacts in the real world.
So why are we seeing this now? Why is this now suddenly become an issue? Because it's changing a little more than it used to be?
It is certainly changing. The Bayh-Dole Act, this is an act from 1988, if memory serves, which encouraged academic researchers with government funding and the universities and employ them to go out and apply for patents and then commercialize their work. So there has, since that act took effect, there has been a steady increase in the number of scientists who have been involved in commercializing their discoveries. I'm talking about the life sciences here. Life science, biology has been tremendously successful. It's funded in large part by NIH and other governments in order to promote human health. And so, you know, this is part of the purpose of the research and of the funding. And a more positive spin on this will be that some of that is starting to come to fruition now.
All right, we're going to come back and talk lots more with Charles Jennings and Mildred Cho and take your questions. So don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about journals and publishing and the change in the way that disclosure for conflict of interest is going through journals. With my guest, Charles Jennings, executive editor for Nature Research Journals in New York, Mildred Cho, senior research scholar, associate director of the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, is the number. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Russell in Tulsa. Hi, Russell.
Hello.
Hi there.
I side with those who are in favor of disclosure as a general rule. And my call was going to be just the observation that in courts of law, where a lot of disputes about science get played out, Those disputes oftentimes rise and fall on the testimony of expert witnesses, and one way that courts know whether or not to allow an expert to say something is whether it appears, whether the opinion they're saying appears in journals. And without disclosure, there could be literally the set of journals with science that is intended to achieve results in litigation or otherwise, and purely financially driven, and certainly lawyers would be handicapped in terms of their ability to ferret that out, as well as others. And I've always operated under the assumption that those types of things were disclosed. So when I heard the topic for your show, I was a little bit taken aback. Mm. And
Are you a lawyer?
Yes, I am.
So, and you're saying you've always depended on these journals for the word, the science, right? And now you're finding out there could be some controversy here.
That's right.
Yeah. Charles, any comment on that?
I think a lot of people depend on us for accurate information. I am happy to hear that the lawyers are also reading us. I completely agree. I think the concern for journals is to publish things that are credible and will withstand challenges to their integrity. And I have to agree that if journals don't have disclosure policies, then they are vulnerable to this type of challenge.
Dr. Cho, any comment?
Yeah, I would also agree. I think that the point the caller raises is more of an issue than it was before because of changes in the standards of evidence in courtrooms. Being published is a piece of evidence that certain scientific evidence is accepted by the scientific community. So then it becomes much more important as to the credibility of that science. And I think it's also, there's some indications that publication for the purposes of waging a specific battle in court is becoming a sort of cottage industry. So disclosure becomes even more important.
Thanks for calling, Russell. Good point.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. In the current issue, Charles, of Nature Neuroscience, Nature Journals announced a new policy on financial disclosures. Can you tell us what it is in broad
yes,
requirements?
Yes, the new policy requires all authors to make a statement that will appear in the journal, and we give them basically three options. They can either say, we have no significant financial interests in this work, or they can say, yes, we do have a financial interest, in which case there's a link to our website and they're asked to detail their interests. Or we do give them a third option, which is to decline to respond to the question. But if they do that, then we publish the fact that they declined to respond, and readers can make what they will of that. I mean, that almost inevitably means that they have something that they don't want to talk about. But it's a courtesy to our authors. A tiny percentage of authors have chosen that option.
I know you can't speak for all the other journals, but do you sense there's going to be a trend in other journals for this kind of disclosure?
I think there already is. It's fairly widespread among the top clinical journals. I like to think the Nature journals have been fairly forward-looking in the context of the basic science literature. We certainly think of ourselves as a very visible group of journals, and part of our hope here is that we will set an example that others will choose to follow.
Has Nature ever rejected a paper because a researcher had a conflict of interest?
As far as I'm aware, no. In general, we just wouldn't do that. So I think this is one point on which I have to disagree with Mildred. We think that it's not our job as editors to evaluate whether the financial interest has distorted the science. If we have evidence that the science is distorted, then we won't publish it. But that's not because of the conflict. That is because the science itself is flawed. The fact that there is a potential to bias the science doesn't mean that the science has been biased. Mm-hmm. And as one editor once said, you don't want to have a policy that would have prevented, for example, Thomas Edison writing about the future of electricity. You know, some of the people who are involved in commercializing their work are also the leading authorities. We want to know what they have to say. Mm-hmm. So if disclosure rather than prohibition, we think, is the way to go.
Mildred, should they ever prohibit someone from who has a conflict of interest because they're being paid and it's known and they admit it? Should they not publish their work?
Well, I think that actually the better place to have that level of control or policing, as the way some people put it, is at with the scientists themselves. Because in some ways, by the time the work has gone to the stage of publication, it may be too late. And I think that's especially important with clinical research, because some of the concerns with financial conflicts of interest or any conflict of interest in clinical research is that patients might be harmed in the course of participating in the research, for example, because the researchers might inadvertently overlook adverse effects from the treatment that is being administered in the study.
Yeah.
And so by the time the publication is ready to go to press or be submitted for publication, the adverse effects or the negative impact of the conflict of interest may have already played out, and with potential life-threatening or serious harm being done to patients. So the place to have that kind of consideration about conflict of interest is before the science even gets done.
Mm-hmm. John, let's go to you in Connecticut. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I just wondered if Dr. Jennings and Dr. Cho could address a point about an inherent bias in the publication and funding mechanisms for the scientific literature. I have to say, I think the full disclosure is necessary, and I think peer review is a really excellent example of science at its best. But since we don't publish negative results generally, and in fact, if you don't have results, your grant agency, if you're on public monies or private foundation monies, won't refund you. There really is, I think, a bias that exists regardless of the funding source. And so it's interesting that, in general, the discussion is singled out private industry monies and not the general phenomena of funding and what you need to do in order to survive as a scientist. Mm.
Charles, any comment?
Certainly agree there's a potential for bias there. If you don't get positive results, journals are not interested, and you won't get your next grant funded. So there is a potential problem. I think in the long term it'll comes out in the wash, because you know claims that are incorrect, eventually, if they're important enough, somebody will challenge them. But yes, you make a good point.
But don't scientists live by negative results? Don't we eliminate the truth? You know, we narrow it down
by having stuff that doesn't work.
I mean. It doesn't sound like we're talking about science anymore.
Well,
we eliminate this, we do this.
Yeah.
Where's the science?
Well, believe me, I mean, if we get a paper
that
if we get a paper that refutes the discovery that got somebody the Nobel Prize last year, believe me, we're going to want to publish it. That is big news. But most negative results are much more mundane than that, and they're frankly not terribly interesting. And they're an awful, as every graduate student knows, they're an awful lot more negative than positive results. And you would have a very unexciting journal if it was devoted only to. In fact, I think there is a journal that is devoted only to negative results. I don't know its circulation, but I can't imagine that it's very large.
Mildred, any comment?
Well, I think the caller actually has a really good point, which is that there are conflicts of interest that are not just financial. So there are incentives in science to drive positive results that are not just the dollar, but wanting to get additional funding, wanting to publish anything at all. And I think the studies that Charles mentioned, including the study that I did, indicated that even studies that were government-funded or non-industry-funded were predominantly those with positive results. And the industry-funded studies had a higher proportion of positive results, but even the government-funded studies had a majority of positive results. So it just points to the situation that all scientists face, which is that they face all kinds of conflicts of interest, not just financial.
Thanks for calling, John.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about research this hour and what kinds of implications there are. Let's go to Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Robert. Welcome to Science Friday. Robert, go ahead.
Hi. Seems like John from Connecticut said approximately the same thing that I was going to bring up. It seems to me that this problem of conflict of interest has existed. It's become exacerbated with the commercial interest, but it has existed ever since we've evolved from that professor from Central Casting who is just seeking the truth to this this funding game that is played. I don't think that even 5% of published scientific research is unfunded now. And I think ever since the NSF and Pentagon funding and at least in the context of engineering, ever since that has happened, that has so much affected the objectivity and the quality of the research that I am very suspect of even the non-commercial research that's published in so-called.
Well, why? Give us a little bit more of why you're suspect of it.
Well, because exactly what you guys said just earlier with John, because professors don't want to, our researchers don't want to publish negative results, mm-hmm. and so that there's going to be a strong incentive for them to take what might be negative or what might even be irrelevant results and turn it or twist it in such a way that it looks positive and it looks relevant when it really isn't. Because if they don't do that, they're not going to be getting their grant, they're not going to be getting their tenure, they're not going to be they're going to have to be looking for a different career than what they're doing. And I think it's gotten worse now with the commercial thing. I think it's moved from 6 digits to 7 digits now. But other than that, I think that this problem has existed since the 60s or the 70s, when so much research. I mean, I don't know if Albert Einstein ever got a big grant at all for what he was doing.
Theorists don't need big budgets.
Pardon me?
I say theorists don't need such big budgets.
Need big brains.
That's right.
Yeah. Big blackboards, maybe.
Right. And I just think, but nonetheless, sometimes theoretical research is worth publishing, but it's not going to be published if it isn't. Somehow made to appear very positive to the audience. And so, I mean, I have some suspicion of a lot of published research. And I think that Martin Anderson, who did this book called Imposters in the Temple, said it best in one chapter called The Glass Bead Game. I just think that, I mean, you're...
All right, we're running out of time here, Robert. We'll get the reference. Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Rob in Washington. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, go ahead.
I'm frankly a little bit surprised that the question of ethics and professional ethics has not yet come up in the conversation. I would think that professionals in the field and their peers would jury themselves. And I think the question of being found out certainly exists in the world of science and publication. I would think that a juried publication, with or without disclosure, would pretty much take care of itself, as well as the professional ethics.
Well, let me get a reaction, because Mildred Cho is an ethicist. Let's see what she has to say about that.
Well, I'm glad you brought up that point, because I think part of the reason why we're facing this issue now is that scientists, especially in the area of biomedical research and clinical researchers, are facing financial conflicts of interest more than they had in the past, and so they're not trained to think about it as an issue, and sometimes get a little insulted that people might accuse them of having a conflict of interest, as if that in itself were a bad thing. But people in other professions have to think about this all the time, and it's part of their training. So, you know, journalists are not allowed to accept payments from the people they write stories about, and the same for, you know, judges, for example. So anyone that is in a profession faces the same issues, and I think scientists are not used to thinking of themselves in that way.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about ethics and medical research this hour, and any kind of research this hour, being published on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato with Mildred Cho and Charles Jennings. We only got about a minute or so left. Charles, and I'll ask you both, Charles and Mildred, we know that there are existing policies with the journals. We talked about that, but I'm getting the impression they're not being watchdogged that much. What happens? Is that right, Charles?
I think that's true. I think many journals claim to have policies on disclosure, and yet there have been surveys that show large discrepancies between the actual rate of disclosure and the percentage of scientists who do have some sort of financial interest. So I think a lot of journals are actually operating what you might call a don't ask, don't tell policy. And the intent of the Nature journals, when we required every paper to have a statement, was to try to avoid that. And I think we have relatively high rates of disclosure, and I think that reflects really the difference between a scientist's willingness to tell what we might call lies of omission versus lies of commission. And I think that's why our disclosure rates are high.
Mildred Cho?
Well, I think that journals are doing a better job now of recognizing the merits of disclosure, but I think that scientists should think about an option that's often not brought up, which is to recuse themselves from the financial ties as opposed to recusing themselves from doing the science. And so I think that's an option that should be not forgotten.
You mean, say I'll do the research, but I'll pledge, or I'm not involved in collecting, reaping the monetary harvest that might come from it?
Right, for specific situations.
And how would you do that practically?
Well, for example, if you have stock options, if you're offered stock options by a sponsor, you could say, well, I'm just not going to accept those stock options while I'm doing research on a product that's related to that creates a financial conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm. And if you're offered a speaking tour, things like that?
I'm still waiting.
So we're mostly talking about tangible options instead of just representing a company in any other way.
Well, but the same principle could apply to any kind of thing, I guess, unless you're actually employed by the company that you're doing the research for. Mm-hmm. But then there's a sort of implicit disclosure there.
All right, we've just about run out of time this hour. I want to thank you both for joining me to talk about this. Is very interesting. Charles Jennings, executive editor for Nature Research Journals in New York, and Mildred Cho, a senior research scholar and associate director of the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. Thank you both for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the rainforest. You don't hear a whole lot about the tropical rainforest these days. And what's happening with them? They're still getting cut down. They're still being burned. A lot of people say, hey, can't we put an end to this? Well, we have a couple of folks coming up after the break who will tell us of a practical way that we can bring business to the rainforest and then make it maybe economically feasible to use the drugs that might come out of all those all that biodiversity that's down there by bringing the business to the forests instead of taking the stuff out to the laboratory. Stay with us. We'll talk about that after this break.